kind of prove to myself and to others that, you know, if you have a dream and you work really hard and you work harder than the competition, you have a little bit of talent, and you you never show up late, you always show up front and center, you're always smiling, you're always eager, you don't let people down, you know, you can overcome almost anything.
You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Today, I'm incredibly excited to have Mike Paul Hughes with me on Hooked on Startups. And you know, Mike, welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
So Mike is, I'm going to read a little bit here actually, because your background is, it's astonishing. So you are a NASA engineer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. You spent the last 20 years working in really complex areas of guidance, navigation, control systems for spacecraft and entry system. I mean, you're a rocket scientist, but you're no ordinary rocket scientist because you received NASA's, is it the Exceptional Achievement Medal? Because you were heavily involved with the control systems for the Deep Impact mission back in 2005. So, so you were with the Jet Propulsion Lab. And recently you moved off the Mars program to work on the Starshade project, which this sounds like it's something out of science fiction. It really does.
It does.
And Starshade is about finding planets outside of our solar system that look like Earth. I know that you found more than, you know, two, but, you know, and if that isn't enough, you play 19 instruments. You're a music producer. You've been on, you're the host of the Hollywood in Space pilot. And, you know, so what do you do in the afternoons?
Well, surprisingly normal, I guess, when I get home.
That's right.
A little bit of a...
As you can see, I mean, everyone's home, as you can see, looks exactly the same as this here, you know.
Yeah, it's not just me. It's my sons, too. I have two sons. My 17-year-old son, Ben, is a bass player, and my 12-year-old son, Ian, is a drummer. And they take right after me. They love science. They love music. They play together. They're into hardcore punk, and it makes the studio rock.
But your story is just amazing, because everyone will assume that you had this Ivy League education and that you'd always wanted to be a rocket scientist, and, you know, that you have more degrees than a thermometer, brain the size of a small planet. So naturally your pathway was into NASA straight out of school, but nothing could be further than from the truth.
No, I do the best I can to dispel that myth, because I think placing rocket scientists, or really anybody, on too high of a pedestal, it makes it unachievable for people to dream. It's not an achievable dream to them. I'll tell you my story. When I was 22 years old, I was a printer and a musician. I played bass in a Philadelphia rock band called Third Uncle. And we had a record out. We had a song on the radio, you know, gigs, girls, following, PA system, rehearsal space, you know, living the life. And I was a printer during the day, but I got fired from my job and the band broke up and my girlfriend dumped me and my car died, all in the period of about a month, in the fall of 85. So I went into a pretty deep depression, as you can imagine. And I got another job in another print shop, but it was just as awful. So I sort of limped along sideways for a couple of months. And then the Challenger, Space Shuttle Challenger, exploded in the end of January 28th, 1986.
That's right.
And it shocked me. It it inspired me. It was a devastating loss to the country.
Yeah.
And the president is on television in tears. A couple days after the accident, a Time magazine came out that featured profiles of the crew members. One of those crew members was Ron McNair. And he was not only an astronaut, a black belt in karate, and a PhD in physics, but he was also a jazz saxophonist. And the fact that he was a musician, it just got into me and it inspired me. So I went into college, really very far against the odds, as I had very poor grades in high school, and I had been in some violence and, you know, drugs, and, you know, just lived that, you know, lived down to the expectations, you know. So I was not really prepared. And the counselor said, you know, you really shouldn't take aerospace engineering.
But what about Big Pete's advice?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I'm in this print shop. And a couple days after Challenger, I got the Time magazine. And I went to my boss in his office to ask him for that Friday afternoon off so I could go back to my old high school and see what it took to enlist in aerospace engineering. And the old man was okay. We weren't that busy at the time, but Big Pete, he was the boss's right-hand man. He followed me out to the shop floor to ream me out. And he says to me, "Engineering? You want to go into engineering? You know, the kids that go into engineering, they know math. They know computers. You don't know math, and you don't know computers."
That's amazing.
Those kids that go into engineering, their parents are rich. You don't have that kind of money, do you?
See?
And it really crushed me, because he was the first person to just basically laugh in my face that this was an unachievable thing.
So Big Pete, clearly not an inspirational speaker. Is that what you're saying here?
No, he was the shop bully. He was the boss. The boss liked him, and he was a gigantic guy, and he intimidated the other employees. And, you know, there were maybe six guys in the shop all day, and, you know, Pete got his way and rewarded him, you know.
Did that make you more determined, though, to think, you know, I'm going to show you your great lump of lard or whatever?
Yeah, in the beginning, it really did, because that first year, I really suffered in order to save the money for tuition, and then I suffered more to get through the calculus. And I did not want to go back to that print shop. It was like the last place in the world that would have been hell for me. It would have been groveling, and I just couldn't ever see myself doing that. So in the first year, it motivated me. And I thought, well, after I graduate, I'll go back there and I'll show my diploma and I'll laugh at him. But after I graduated, I had other things on my mind. I never went back.
But that, I mean, you say after a year, but I mean, all the way through, because I was just listening to some of the stuff that you've, some of the talks that you've been on. I mean, the story is that, you know, you save up the money, you don't have the necessary qualifications, so you have to burn the midnight oil, literally,
yeah,
to get to the point where you can start, you know, just to get to the beginning. And there's this great piece where you talk about one of the tutors at the college that showed you this bell curve. It was, and she said on the right hand side, you know, in this tiny little gray area, right at the very right, this is where rocket scientists are, and you're way over here on the left. See this X?
That's right. That was a devastating moment at the time. I felt that she was the counselor, and she was supposed to be helping me with course selection and, you know, how to plan my first year and make sure that I know how to study and, you know, give me encouragement. But instead, she was basically waving me off and telling me that I didn't read and she didn't understand me. And I was trying to tell her that I was willing to do the work, but she didn't want to. She thought that there was some kind of a predetermined species, I think, that the you're not one of these people.
Yeah. And
turns out I am.
That's a massive challenge, because all you have at that point is this burning desire with no proof. And so you are the easiest target for people, particularly in a position of trust, such as the counselor, to chop you off at the knees effectively. So it must have taken an iron will and determination to say, okay, everyone's telling me that I can't do this, but I know I can do it. So, where did you find that determination from?
Some of it was, I knew that I had talent. I knew there were things I wanted to know. I wanted to know how the spectrum worked, how colors worked. I wanted to know how bodies orbited. I needed to know that. It's hard to explain where the inspiration or the motivation came from, but I knew what I didn't want as much as I knew what I wanted.
Absolutely. So go back. So you're 20, 25 at this stage?
22 when I had the epiphany, and then 23 when I entered.
So again, 23, it's pretty young. I mean, and it's so easy just to be, to have the wind taken out of yourselves at that point. So again, you go first lecture. So you made it through selection, as it were, you're in first lecture. And again, you tell the story of calculus and how clearly at that stage you were no expert on calculus, yet you were surrounded by, you know, 12-year-olds who were
18-year-olds, but people that were sharp and had just taken calculus in high school and had aced it, and they were sitting next to me. And that first day of calculus, when the professor went to the board, he filled it with so much math so quickly that I couldn't keep up, and I didn't understand the language. I couldn't make the symbols with my hand, and the notes looked like scratch. And I went into a panic attack. And at the end of the class, as it ends as fast as it begins, he asks if there's anybody wants to talk with him for a couple of minutes. And I'm crushed. I'm looking down and I'm too late to rise. There's two other kids before me in line to talk to the professor. And the first says, "Professor, I had all this in high school and I aced it. Can I just get out of this and take the final exam?" And the professor writes him a note and says, "Yeah, here's how you do that." Sends him off. And then the next kid says the exact same thing. And now it's my turn. And I'm a jellyfish. I'm looking up at this professor of mathematics and I'm a bass player. And I said, "Professor, I don't know what you just said. I haven't been in a classroom in 5 years.
Amazing. Now, yeah.
I'm here to learn. I will do whatever it takes, whatever you say, to be an aerospace engineer." And he jots me a note, and it's his office hours. And I show up the next day outside his locked door with all my papers sprawled into the floor, into the hallway, half an hour before he comes. And he unlocks the door. And then we began.
Yeah.
It was some of the hardest nights and times I had ever put in. Is relearning algebra, learning trigonometry, and calculus all at the same time.
But did you have, and at that point, were you able to create a clear vision of what you would be doing? Did that dream of yours become more clear, or was it still just?
I had no idea. I had no idea what it would be like to work for NASA. I'd never known anybody that had worked for NASA. I lived in a blue-collar neighborhood. There was no college-level inspiration around me. My father didn't go to college. My mother didn't even go to high school. I had 8 older brothers and sisters. None of them went to college. So nobody went to calculus. Nobody had any idea what an engineer did. I just knew that if I did really well, I would get to do what I wanted to do.
Yes. And I guess it's that, and that drive. So again, fast forward sort of 2 to 3 years, it seems you got better at calculus, to put it mildly.
Yeah, I ended up putting in more time and learning more and better. I went to the backup text and I did optional problems. I made up my own problems. I went to the professor every week. I aced calculus. I aced Calc 2, Calc 3. I aced physics. I aced electromagnetism, thermodynamics. I aced them all. I just was Batman. And when it came to quantum mechanics, there were only 4 of us left.
And it's a bit like those movies where you see, you know, people joining SEAL Team 1, where there's like 30 guys, and over a period of time, the bells ring. So you, bottom left of the bell curve, suddenly you're there, atop of the top of the class with just you and 3 others.
Yeah, I had at quantum mechanics, there were 4 of us, and there were 30 before about 2 years earlier, and now there's 4. And I aced that too. And I graduated magna cum laude, number 2 in my class out of 180. Wow. With honors and distinction. And they gave me a medal for my scholarship. They called me a scholar. So I kind of proved to myself and to others that, you know, if you have a dream and you work really hard and you work harder than the competition, you have a little bit of talent, and you never show up late, you always show up front and center, you're always smiling, you're always eager, you don't let people down, you know, you can overcome, you know, almost anything.
And so fast forward now, so you're there, but you're different to, I guess, pretty much every other NASA engineer that you meet. Is that a fair thing to say? Or
there are a few others with very difficult backstories. There are a few others that, there's nobody that was so far down in the scholarship level. I'm about the poorest student high school that I know in rocket science. Most of them were pretty good students in high school. I know one lady who had a very difficult time, and that she was from a very small town. They told her, aerospace engineering, you know, maybe you should cut hair.
Well, I can see the parallel. Exactly. it's a natural choice, obviously. Yes.
But yeah, there are people out there that will steer you away from your dream because they don't understand your moxie. They're normal, and they don't know that you're ready to do extraordinary things. Now you got to swim upstream, and that's an extraordinary thing. But there's a lot of people out there that I faced early on that advised me, you know, maybe you should go to business. Maybe you should try community college, you know. What about the electricians union, you know? That might be a safe thing for you.
I suppose there is a parallel between electricals, so, you know, electrics and guidance system for Orion. There is a slight crossover on the Venn diagram there, I suppose.
Well,
that guy was probably the closest.
Because I was the bass player in the band and I had the PA. Can you tell? Right? I'm the guy with the PA. And that means I had to troubleshoot all the ground problems. And that means I had to, you know, understand like how the equipment worked and, you know, what where noise came from. And if you cross the wires, you have problems. And so 10 years later, after college, I was on the spacecraft floor in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, troubleshooting an anomaly. It was just like a PA rack. It was a bit of noise that was getting in through the system, and I had to, you know, go and move the cables. And except now I was wearing a white suit with it.
Well, that's so. Now this is what I want to know about. So there's the. I mean, it's a fantastic story of getting there, but this is just the beginning. So, what was it like when you stepped through the doors for the first time with your identity badge that said, you know, Mike Paul Hughes, engineer with the NASA logo all over it? I mean, do you remember that moment?
Yeah, well, my first job was with, I co-opted with the Naval Air Test Center. So I got a taste of it as an undergrad, and it helped pay for my last 2 years. But when I finally graduated, I went to General Electric Astrospace Division in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And I do remember that first day, and I had a tie on and a jacket and slacks that I had just gone out and bought because I had to borrow money to buy it because I didn't have a paycheck yet, to buy clothes because they expected you to dress professionally. And back in those days, that meant you wear a tie every day and none of this pink shirt stuff.
Yeah.
You wear a white shirt, dark tie, white shirt. And I did. And I was among engineers and I was making really good money. For the first time in my life.
But was it, and did you think this is everything I've dreamt of? Or was that the point where you could just explode in terms of creativity? I mean, what's it like, you know, working in these places? Is it a place where your headphones are on and you're glued to your computer trying to figure out, you know, how to build a high speed split level taper shank reamer or something? Or,
No. I mean, a good example might be, you know, you're a young engineer and you're brought in by a more senior engineer that needs help. And that engineer, she knows how to run the tools. She knows how to do the analysis. She knows which meetings to go to. So she guides you and, you know, gives you, a simulation to run. And it's well within the coursework that you've been exposed to.
Yeah.
And she's seen your resume because she picked you and she talked to you in the interview. She knows you're an expert at this particular piece of control authority. And that's what they did. They give you, and then you learn. You learn how to run the tools. And you go into meetings, and there's always meetings, and you have problems. And people come up and they say, you know, the thing we talked about last week, it's not going to work. And that's energy for engineers, because now there's some, what do you mean it's not going to work? Well, the tolerances are too tight. We're not going to be able to build it. Or, you know, they can't spin the wheel that fast. The lubrication's only spec to, you know, 70 degrees C. Or there's all these kind of problems that come up, and then you have to use your creativity. And that's where you start to think about the system and you trade. Like you say, well, if I make the solar arrays a little bit bigger, I have more power on board, then I can, if I have more power, then I can have a bigger camera. And then, and you can start to solve some of your problems using the resources that are available. And you go back to your office and you look at a computer. But for me, it was never staring at a computer for 10 hours a day. I wrote code. I did simulations. I wrote tens of thousands, 100,000 lines of code in my career, probably. But for me, it was never looking at the code. For me, it was looking into another window, another universe, another plane of reality where I was a god inside that reality, because it was math. Whatever I could think in my head, I could try it out and test it in the computer and see how it worked. And I could bring it back to my leaders and show, well, here's a trajectory I planned. Here's a maneuver I did. You know, it used less fuel, it's less time, more efficient. And then it enables us to get back to this other target in time. I'm solving problems. And then before you know it, you know, you're a senior engineer.
If you go back to the sort of the early 90s, which is, I guess, when you were doing this, I mean, computers then were nowhere near as powerful as clearly they are today. So how much more of that was sort of intuition and actually thinking in physical terms what these problems are?
Well, maybe because I had to fire hose myself in the early year, after 1 year, I had a really strong foundation in math and physics. Really 2 years. The first 2 years, you get all your physics and all your calculus is done. And I really overdid it. So that when in the later years, even in my work world, I was not shy of anything having to do with math or physics. And I was very adept and able to maneuver in the conversations with the more senior engineers that, I had that knack, I guess, for doing it, so I could petition for the jobs.
And what was your first moment where you sat back in your chair thinking, holy crap, I found something that, you know, like, was there a moment when you know what I mean? That first moment when you're looking around to see if anyone's seen you.
Nobody ever did. Oh, I've done a lot of things that nobody has ever done, and I've advanced the art in a number of areas in papers and such. But one of the first times I did it, I had discovered that one of our systems for using magnetics to control the momentum on board the spacecraft, that system was always believed to be stable by the engineers, but there was no proof. And I had established a mathematical proof, and I had realized that that was cool. That was like, you put a coin in the machine and you get that warm fuzzy. Now, I worked for it. I wrote the paper, but people were impressed. I was impressed. I was impressed with myself.
But does it feel still today like it's this huge puzzle rather than being something that's mathematics, that it is this massive question, this series of puzzle after puzzle after puzzle? Is that what it is to do what you do?
You know, there's really nothing I haven't at least dabbled or touched. Well, that's not true. I mean, there's stuff I don't know. I mean, there's always stuff you don't know, and there's always the layers that you talk about.
But did you find that your previous experience outside that those 5 years as a bass guitarist for a punk band, no less? It wasn't a rock band. I think it was a punk band, wasn't it?
You played some punk songs pretty hard.
Did you find that made it much easier for you to act as a bridge, a human bridge behind these different skill sets? You know, were you the engineer that could speak to humans?
Well, I was not afraid of the stage. I was not afraid of being in front of a room full of people. I had played, you know, maybe 300 shows or something. I'd been in a cover band. I'd been in a bunch of original bands by that time. So I was not afraid of people. And when I spoke, I was not uncomfortable with it.
Yeah. But it must, I can just feel it. It must have been so satisfying just to be able to grab the attention of people, to be able to act as the conduit for ideas around these different departments that probably move the whole project forward faster. Is that?
Yeah, that's a lot of what I do these days is, you know, bringing teams together and, you know, solving problems that are, you know, sort of slip in between the cracks in the institution is organizations. And sometimes they don't always talk to each other. You know, having been a musician, it gave me a couple of edges. It gave me the feeling like you can improv through almost anything. Like, I've had these gigs where you didn't know where you were going to be, what time, you know, problems, equipment failures, singer not showing up, and you had to just work through it, right? And then, so when I was in engineering, it was like, well, there's a video projector and there's overheads in the beginning. And, you know, there's sound and there's a teleconference. It's all the same stuff. It's getting people together. You're setting a time and a place and logistics and, you know, you have to get coffee and stuff, you know, all this stuff I was already good at.
Yes.
you know, getting people together.
And did you find that, was that, were there moments where, I mean, the other, my question really is more technical in the sense that when you're doing a lot of the work that you're doing, is some of it guesswork? Or because if you're trying to figure out how a rocket is going to move in space, how do you know what it's like in space? Do you, I mean, how do you find all of these different coefficients, and do you have to model?
We have Newton's laws, and most of our stuff is Newton's laws, which are, you know, 1685 was published. So it's old stuff. I mean, this is Industrial Revolution mathematics that, you know, comet predict, Halley's Comet.
Yeah.
We didn't discover the comet. He predicted its orbit using Newton's laws very accurately. So many years after he had died, it came back. And he had predicted when it would come back to the month and year. It's the same stuff we use now, except Halley did it by hand, and it took him months to do a calculation we can do in, you know, 10 seconds. Actually, I think it's, you know, a few days to code it, and then we can run it in microseconds.
And so my next question is really, it's the impact of artificial intelligence, because there's a lot of the things, as you say, are based on laws that are 400 plus years old. Is there going to come a point in our lifetimes, do you think, when with the application of AI, because AI is able to see things without the I suppose the walls that we have as a, you know, as a human mindset, do you think we're going to see some huge leaps forward with artificial intelligence behind the wheel?
I do. I think artificial intelligence will be, here's artificial intelligence. A car is speeding towards an intersection, and there's two people in the intersection, an old man and a young child. The car has to decide who to hit. That's artificial intelligence. That's coming.
And I think really that is because what you're doing now. So you're now working with the Starshade project, which is something that you've moved on literally in the last sort of couple of weeks or so. So that must be so exciting to have that together with the ability to see things that in the last few years we were completely unable to see with all the various telescopes. And we've got the launch of the James Webb telescope as well. So are you at the point now where it's almost as if your dream has renewed itself? Like everything you've been doing up until this point was training for this particular exoplanets project.
It's a weird way into the exoplanets program. But yeah, I where do I start? The exoplanets, Starshade, first off, let me say that I work for JPL, but I'm not a spokesperson for JPL. I'm not a spokesperson for NASA. What I say is my own. It's I'm my own person, just an engineer speaking to my friend, Matthew. So having said that, disclaimer, Project Starshade is something that NASA has. It's a pre-phase A, it's a proposal. It's an idea. It wants to become a flight project. It's not a flight project. The idea is they want to put flower-shaped spacecraft in front of a star and block its light so you can see the planets. And that has never been done before. And that has rejuvenated me.
Yeah.
Because most of the stuff that I've been working on has been mechanical in nature. It's been Newton's laws, orbits, thrusters, rockets, impacts, collisions, parachutes, oscillations, all these things are Newton's laws in some application or another. And it's really cool stuff, and it's rich, and I've spent 25 years on it. But this Project Starshade is optics. It's light. It's also, it's very close to discovery.
Yeah.
Of new life. We're going to find life outside the solar system, I believe, within the next 20 years by these starshades.
Because, and I remember back in February, there was a huge flurry of excitement. Because I think there's I don't know what a red dwarf is other than a dwarf that is red, but apparently it means something else in astrophysics. But there's a red dwarf that has its own set of planets, and two or three of them may be able to support life.
Yeah, there's if you don't mind having a star that doesn't have the yellow glow that we do, the criteria for habitability is liquid water on the surface. So generally, that's interpreted as a distance from the sun, from the star. If it's closer than Venus, water will boil off. If it's farther than Mars, water will freeze. So there's a zone there we call the habitable zone or the Goldilocks zone.
Yeah.
But it's incomplete because it says nothing about the atmosphere of the planet. If it's a very thick, heavy atmosphere, there may be liquid water there, even though the planet is, you know, far outside of, you know, what we consider, you know, Mars-like, right? It could be Jupiter's orbit, but with a very thick atmosphere, it could be very hot at the surface because there's a really horrible greenhouse, and there's enough energy for liquid water.
But does this take you back to the day when, because when I was doing some research on you, I found a huge coincidence. There's actually an asteroid with the same name as you. So, but does that take you back to the time when you're actually discovering things where it's not just about the mechanics, which is obviously hugely interesting, but that sense of adventure and of frontiership must make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up.
Well, I'm first and foremost an engineer. I'm a scientist because I'm curious, but I did not get a physics degree, and I did that on purpose because I didn't want to be in the lab. I didn't want to be doing the theory. I wanted to be building and flying and testing. So I transfer everything you said about discovery to the tests that we do.
Yes.
For example, when I was working on the Orion program for Lockheed Martin for NASA, which is the Apollo-like space shuttle replacement, when we would do drop tests, we'd drop the crew module out of an aircraft from 25,000 feet, and I would be on the desert floor with binoculars looking up. And watching the motions.
Yes.
And some of these motions are predictable, and some of it is you're going to hope for the best, and then there's always winds. So there's a lot of what's going to happen. You know, is this going to work?
Yes.
And if you have a failure and you have your crew module crash into the desert floor, which happened once in 2008, it was not my test, but that happened. It's devastating, and it can set you back. And then you wonder, are we going to be able to get humans back into space?
Wow.
So it's a different journey.
This is all very real stuff. I mean, that's the thing. And so I got another question. And forgive my question here. Star Wars or Star Trek?
For me, it's Star Trek. And that's for a very... very good reason. Actually, I'm a Star Wars fan too. I love Star Wars. I've seen them all more than once, except for Rogue One. But Star Trek is science fiction.
Yeah.
Star Wars is fantasy. It's religion. Star Trek has Spock. Spock questions.
Yeah.
He can't have the power, Captain. There must be an energy source around here. Where are they keeping the computer?
Yes. Yes.
That's Spock. And it forces you as a child, and for me as a child, to think, it's a cliche, but outside the box.
Yeah.
It's to there's energy. There's only so much of it. If it seems too good to be true, if somebody's lying to you, there's some game, there's some smoke and mirrors. And you can be clever, more clever than that person by being like Spock. And that's the influence I got. I had a little cassette tape recorder. I walked around and I recorded my little notes as a tricorder. I searched for life signs. Yeah, I did that.
But I think there may be a little bit of Captain James T. Kirk in there as well. Exactly. Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kirk. I mean, the reason I say that is because, again, going back to the exoplanets thing, there must be, is there a bit of tension where you've got scientists saying, look, you know, we just want to go through and find these. And there's another side of the team saying, well, no, let's focus. Let's find life. You know, so do you get that?
It's a wonder to witness the scientists at work when they're having their debates and they're trying to sway the conversation and convince each other.
Yes.
What should we do? It's fascinating. They have all the behaviors of mammals. They can be very polite and gentle and kind and respectful, but they can also behave like baboons and insult each other.
This is all in the name of science, though, so it's acceptable.
Sometimes, you know, going back into history, there's scientists get into fights with each other over who gave who credit.
Yeah.
Going back into history. So it happens today. And even in the exoplanet domain, there are people that publish and have not, you know, given credit to the other side. And there's these different universities and different collaborations. And it's a shame, I think, because they're all working on the same good mission.
Yes. But again, it's probably what happens is over time, you just become inured to the surroundings. So these huge, great objects covered in gold foil sort of lose their attraction. So I guess if you move from one project to another, that's what I mean about getting this spark of enthusiasm.
That I thought I left back in the print shop, right? Because here I am at the peak of humanity, actually searching for other life around other stars, finding planets, working with the greatest minds, MIT, Princeton, Colorado, and Caltech. And people still behave like baboons. There's still emotion that drives their anger, and they're still angered over resources. They compete for the control of resources. NASA centers compete for control. Now, some of it is necessary and good because it drives competition. But there should be something in the highest human intellect, in the intellectuals, the highest human intellectuals that clicks and say, you know what? I can't get my thing across if I'm going to not include the entire community, or I need to behave with civility with everybody at all phases of their career. But these kind of ethics are still being introduced into these industries.
Is it a bit like the medical profession? Because certainly speaking from my experience as being an outsider, but with some insight into the UK medical profession, UK hospitals are Victorian in many cases. In other words, when you go into a hospital, you normally have to adjust your watch by turning them back 50 years. Is it the same sort of hierarchies and do you almost feel it's this tension between the great work that we're doing, but these stupid politics I've got to deal with?
Well, yeah, you know, politics, bureaucracy, it's necessary for us humans to work in organizations.
I guess it is. I guess it's just one of those it's one of those unavoidable things. That's it's probably the thing that makes it work. It's that.
I talked before about how I can go between these organizations and get them to, you know, solve problems and come together. You know, that is what comes. That's the good that comes out of having hierarchy and organizational boundaries and expert disciplines and groups and managers. The bad stuff is that there's personalities and, you know, people are, you know, we weren't given the education in EQ. We were all about IQ.
Yeah. I think that's common. So in other words, there's still an enormous amount of hope.
What's hopeful is that the people that get selected for leadership are generally the ones that naturally have developed some kind of EQ. They're socially, they're likable, they have friends, they care about people, you know, in and out of the workplace. Those are the people that get promoted up. But you still have people that, you know, were hired back in 1982, and now they're at the end of their career, and they never heard about EQ. That book was written in the 90s. Yes.
But I guess all of this is going to be, there's going to be so many seismic changes because of, you know, AI and other sort of technologies that I guess, in 20 years' time, the landscape in 10, 15 years' time will be completely different, and probably so much more faster moving and exciting maybe than what's happening now, if that's possible.
AI has the potential to do what the internet did or what electricity did.
Wow.
Electricity is probably the biggest transformative technology in humanity. I mean, even beyond the wheel. And the internet is very transformative. I think artificial intelligence, it's like when you're playing the keyboard and it's letting you play, but then if you mess up a note before that note is played, it corrects it for you.
Yeah.
Because it knows what you wanted to play because it knows you. And if you're a jazz player, it knows how you think.
But it's also, it's being able to think without those boundaries, as we were saying before. So now must be, you know, I mean, it's always a very exciting time. So
it's all enabled by our vast resources of memory.
Yes.
Extremely cheap prices and our vast computing resources, computer chips, 3.6 gigahertz, octa-core, that kind of stuff that I got in this rocket ship. Has enabled us to be able to put part of our thinking outside our bodies.
Wow.
You know, but we've been doing that for maybe 50,000 years. We've been taking part of our ideas and putting them outside our bodies, storing, you know, stones and abacus and paper, and then, you know, memory chips, right? Magnetic tape, vinyl. So it's part of the progression. I think AI is going to be a good thing. It's going to make our lives easier.
Wow. I can just, yeah. Well, it must be, you know, such an exciting time, but I'm going to move on to my questionnaire now. So I have 10 questions in my questionnaire, which has nothing to do with rocket science. I'd have to thank James Lipton from Inside the Actor's Studio for these. So I'm borrowing them from him. So moving off from NASA and space and the search for exoplanets, what is your favorite word?
Relativity.
And what is your least favorite word?
Negativity.
And what are you most excited about right now?
Search for life.
Wow. I got to tell you, I get a lot of different answers to that. Yours is probably up there. What turns you off right now?
Money.
What sound or noise do you love?
The lute, the Kurdish lute.
Wow. And what sound or noise do you hate?
Crying, human crying.
And what is your favorite curse word?
I don't curse. I avoid it, except on very rare occasions.
I think just staring at someone probably does the trick, actually.
I think cursing is lack of proper adjectives. If you use the F word too much, you probably didn't learn all your adjectives.
Although it has to be said that the F word is one of the most flexible words on the planet. So it's
you can use it for everything.
So what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Well, I like music producing, but I think film directing might be one.
Fantastic. And what would you not like to attempt? What profession would you not like to attempt?
Auto mechanic.
And if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
So I'm an atheist. But I'll answer that question as if God exists and I was well and my life was ended. I think it would be, "You finally made it."
I was thinking you were going to say something like, "God said, if you'd have just gone 3 degrees right, you would have found it." And that's what you get for being an atheist. That's right. The sense of irony. Well, listen, Mike, I can't begin to thank you enough. It's been just so amazing talking to you. And I can't wait to get everyone to listen to, some of these amazing things that you've been doing. So how do people find out more about what you're doing? How do they get hold of you? How do they follow your progress?
Well, Mike Paul Hughes on Facebook. I'm the only Mike Paul Hughes on Facebook. I don't have 5,000 friends, so go ahead and send me friend requests. I interact with a lot of people, especially young people that are uncertain about what to do with their career. I mentor people that have dabbled in science, want to do it to perhaps try it for real and to become an engineer or a scientist. But Facebook, if you reach out to me, I will respond.
Wonderful. Great. Thank you. And I, look forward to, I just feel like I have the brain the size of a pea now. So I'm going to go and...
I quite enjoyed it. You're very welcome. And let's do it again somehow. I'll have you over to the studio.
I look forward to it. That's brilliant. Thanks again.